Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Even in the opinion everywhere age of the internet, editorial pages like the Washington Post's still pack a punch. Fred Hyatt runs those pages for the Post. Their editorials, their columnists on immigration, guns, budgets, war, and peace. And Hyatt's telling a story on the side these days as well, of a young woman trying to save her father from a Chinese prison. This hour, On Point Fact and New Fiction with the Washington Post's Fred Hyatt. You can join us on air or online on Washington, on Beijing, on love and family and political imprisonment. Join us anytime digitally at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. This conversation never ends. Joining me now from Washington is Fred Hyatt, editorial page editor for The Washington Post, where he writes editorials and a biweekly column, former Post correspondent in Tokyo and Moscow. His new book, a young adult novel, is called 9 Days, inspired by the true story of a young woman trying to get her political dissident father out of prison in China. Fred Hyatt, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
Good. With everything on your plate, and we'll talk about some of it in this hour, with all of that, the story that inspired this piece of fiction grabbed you. How did it get through and grab you, you news-hardened veteran, so hard?
It grabbed me because I met a real person named Tiana Wang, who came to Washington 4.5 years ago after she graduated from high school with a story about her father, who had been imprisoned in China. And she came here not really knowing anybody, but determined to spend a year lobbying Congress and the State Department and trying to bring attention to her father's case.
We're going to hear from Tiana. She's she's in Taiwan now. She'll join us in a few minutes here. Tell us about her story and the story you're telling. I guess start with yours, Fred. You've sort of embroidered, elaborated, changed the scene a little bit, but you've got young people trying to sway big powers, out of family and love, and yes, political dissident is right in the middle of it.
So, yeah, my story is fiction. The real Tiana certainly helped inspire it. But in my book, there's two kids, Ethan and Tiana, who are finishing up 10th grade at a high school in Washington. And when her father goes missing in Hong Kong, the two of them decide nobody else is going to do it, so they have to go find him. And they set off, of course, without parental permission, and have adventures that take them from Hong Kong into Vietnam and further and further into danger as they try to find out what's happened to her father.
Let's hear from the young woman whose real story inspired your story, 9 Days, if we could, Fred. Tiana Wang joins us right now from Taipei in Taiwan. 23 years old. She's dedicated a big chunk of her life, a young life, to trying to free her father, Wang Bingzhang, who has been in jail in China for more than 10 years now. Tiana Wang in Taiwan, thank you very much for joining us. Where's your father and why?
Thank you for having me. My father is currently being held in a small cell in Shaoguan, on the outskirts of Shaoguan, which is a city that is about 3 hours away from Guangzhou. Guangzhou is about 2-3 hours away from Hong Kong. And he's there because, he was, in 2003, my father was sentenced in a closed-door trial where no evidence or witnesses were presented, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment in solitary confinement, essentially for fighting for what he believed in.
I want to look at how that happened. Fred Hyatt in Washington, give us a sense of Tiana's father and his significance. Why would the Chinese government have him on their screen? Why would they have gone after him? We'll hear that story, but why?
Wang Bingzhang was a leader of the overseas democracy movement in North America after the massacres of Tiananmen, when people inside China no longer could really talk about democracy. And obviously there were people in China who saw that as a threat. As always, when you try and figure out why does an autocratic government go after one person and not another, I think even trying to get into the guessing game is kind of letting them have a little bit of a victory. And because there's no knowing sort of what motivates them. But we
do know he was prominent. He was critical. He was voicing things they don't want to hear voiced.
Absolutely. And that, you know, even, not only within China, but even outside of China, they regarded it as a threat.
Tiana, in Fred's book, 9 Days, he has the father of the young woman, girl, really, in his book, high school anyway, snatched out of Hong Kong. What's the actual story? What happened with your father, Tiana?
So my father, in June 2002, my father went missing. We knew that he had been traveling in Vietnam at the time, and then he suddenly disappeared. For 6 months after his disappearance, my family tried desperately to find information about his whereabouts, and even pressed the Chinese government to ask if they knew where if they had any information, but they denied this. In December 2002, we found out that the Chinese government had him in custody, and what we later found out from my father was that he was in Vietnam having lunch near the Vietnamese-Chinese border when disguised Chinese thugs beat and blindfolded him and put him on a boat and forced him into China. And there he was left in a temple and then conveniently picked up by Chinese police momentarily. And he was held there for 6 months incommunicado before we found out where he was.
Do you know if there was Vietnamese cooperation in that apparent kind of kidnapping?
We don't know very much about the circumstances of the kidnapping. We did press the Vietnamese government for information about my father. They only had records of him entering entering Vietnam and no record of him leaving. And the thugs who kidnapped my father were not Vietnamese-speaking individuals. They spoke Chinese. So we don't know the extent of Vietnamese cooperation, if any at all.
He's been in prison for a long time. Was there a trial?
There was a one-day trial in early 2003. It happened closed door. There was no evidence, no witnesses, no family members were allowed to attend. My father himself was not allowed to speak. And it lasted, I think, not even a day.
What's his condition now, Tiana?
He's not doing too great. My father has a list of health conditions that has steadily been getting worse. He suffers from phlebitis, severe hay fever, and has had 3 strokes thus far. But I think what worries my family the most is the decline of his mental health. He's severely depressed and is starting to give up hope himself of the possibility of freedom.
What about the conditions in the prison? Solitary confinement or otherwise?
Yes, he's being kept in solitary confinement. As from what we understand, the prisons are segregated according to their crimes, and my father is the only political prisoner being kept in that prison, so he's by default in solitary confinement.
And how is he treated? Is he just ignored, or is he, I don't know, what's his life like there?
Well, he spends most of his time in his cell. He's allowed some exercise during the day. He's allowed to see other prisoners and interact with them, but not allowed to speak to them. I think this is because they don't want him spreading any ideas. So, so sometimes he's allowed to, if they have like a performance or something like that, he's allowed to sit in the audience, but not communicate
Your mother and father named you Tiana, very unusual Chinese name. They named you after Tiananmen Square. And, of course, 1989, the big pro-democracy demonstration and crackdown there. This must have been an incredible, wait for you to carry? I mean, you've stepped up and tried to help him, but he's still in prison.
Well, I don't think that my parents intended it for it to be a burden. But given the circumstance of his imprisonment, it's inevitably a constant reminder of the dreams that my father had for his country and perhaps what my role would be in it, and also a reminder of the responsibility I have for him now.
Fred, are you trying to bring attention to this particular case with your work of fiction? Is it working?
You know, it was the name, I think, that really, after I met Tiana and read her, the incredible op-ed she'd written for The Post, it was the name that stuck with me. And when I wrote this novel, you know, I was thinking, I mean, every kid in some ways has expectations from family and parents and tries to figure out how to, you know, merge those expectations with what you feel inside. And it's true of both the characters in my book, but to be named Tiana and then have a dissident in prison, it's just a kind of responsibility, as she calls it, as a burden, as most of us might call it, that most of us can't imagine. So certainly, I'm hoping that I've written a good adventure story, but I'm also hoping, for kids who are interested in the wider world and maybe want to read about something more than zombies, although I have nothing against zombies.
Kids fighting for freedom for a father in prison. Fred Hyatt, editorial page editor at The Washington Post. Please stand by there in Washington. And Tiana Wong, we're very glad you're with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour with Washington Post editorial page editor Fred Hyatt about his new Inspired by a True Story fiction on an imprisoned dissident in China and his daughter's fight to free him. Fred joins us from Washington. With us from Taipei in Taiwan is the young woman on whose family story this story was based, Tiana Wong. 23 years old now, inspired the young adult novel by Fred Hyatt. Her father, pro-democracy Chinese dissident Wang Bingzhang, has been jailed in China for more than 10 years. In 2008, she met Fred after she submitted the op-ed piece, Fighting for My Father's Freedom, to the Washington Post. Tiana, you took a year off back when you first got to know Fred to try and to come to Washington and raise alarm, raise attention, change the situation. What did you learn from that year's effort and experience?
Well, I decided to go to D.C. during my father's sixth year of imprisonment. By that time, I think that my family was already feeling pretty exhausted from keeping up the struggle to bring awareness to my father. The year I spent in D.C. was very enlightening and exciting. But I learned that every little endeavor takes tremendous amount of effort. Everything that you want to do, whether it's mobilizing the media or getting support from the government, everything just it takes an incredible amount of effort to get anything done.
Yeah, you're up against big powers there. Fred Hyatt's new book is called 9 Days. Of course, the real world is rolling on around this as well. On Friday, the U.S. State Department put out its annual report on international human rights. And here was Secretary of State John Kerry talking with reporters about that country-by-country human rights report, saying it's blunt about freedoms under threat.
There are people of courage, amazing courage around the world, fighting for these rights, and we need to stand up for them and stand behind them.
And here saying that the critiques are clear-eyed and tough if they need to be.
They're honest, and they need to be, because our policies are grounded in a clear-eyed assessment of governments as they are, not how they want to be or how they pretend to be.
Fred Hyatt, editor of the Washington Post editorial page. Fred, you've spent time, plenty of time in Asia, as I well know. Here you've got Beijing coming back, what is it, today? And slamming the human rights record of the United States in response to that report that Secretary of State Kerry is talking about right there, saying, look, you've got gun violence, you've got military operations around the world. You've got your own problems. Political donations that corrupt your American democracy. China saying, back off our human rights record.
Yes. I mean, that's kind of an annual ritual now. And I think it's true. I haven't read this year's report, but traditionally, annually, the State Department does publish quite an honest account of other people's records. Other countries then strike back in various ways, which to my mind shows that the honesty with which the State Department speaks has some impact. The real question is then what happens with policy and to what extent does U.S. policy take into account the honest report that their Human Rights Bureau has just put out.
Tiana, do you think that anybody, let's say even a big power like the United States, has the power to make China change its policy here on your dad, let's say?
I'd like to think so. I think that the only way to get my father out of prison is international pressure. Historically, that's the only thing that's ever worked. It's to make China realize that keeping him in prison is worse off than letting him go.
Let's go to Tim in Jacksonville, Florida, calling in. Hi, Tim. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. My comment is and question is that from what I've seen and from what most of us have seen, China has done more to educate people and bring peasants into the middle class. In fact, they've doubled the world middle class, helping a lot of people. I'd like to ask what her father's interest is. Is he Taiwanese? Is he one of the criminal elements that had to flee? I mean, what's going on there?
Well, a lot of spin on that question. Maybe there's a lot of spin on everything here. Tiana, this is exactly China's claim, and you've heard it, and they made it again in their critique of American human rights. This report released yesterday by China said, look, I guess as we know, China defines human rights basically in terms of lifting the standard of living of lots of people. The sort of underlying assertion is that's what China's done. So back off. What do you say to that perspective, Tiana?
I just wanted to make it clear my father was a Chinese national, and he was he went to the U.S., Canada, and then the U.S. later on. So that's where he spent most of his time doing
after
his
Tiananmen. Mm-hmm.
Right. Before that, mm-hmm. He left in 1979.
Oh.
Just in response to the comment, I think that that's great, and my father also acknowledges the great strides that China has made in enriching the lives of millions of people in China, but that doesn't give anyone the right to put someone in prison and sentence them to life in prison for expressing dissent.
Fred, have things changed? Yes, please.
I was just going to throw in, I agree with Tiana. You know, I think China over the last 20, 30 years has brought more people out of poverty than ever anywhere in the world in history. And it's an incredible thing. But when you look at what its own government now says, they're acknowledging that as Chinese get more personal freedom, more freedom to travel, to choose what they want to do with their lives, they're also demanding some degree of political freedom. And particularly, they're beginning to resent the kind of corruption and high-handedness that comes with a one-party state. And yet the news today, after the new leadership in China had announced an anti-corruption crusade, obviously in reaction to this kind of popular opinion, the news today is that they've been arresting anti-corruption crusaders. It's something that in the long run, what Tiana's father had been advocating for, I feel, and I think a lot of people think, is what's going to be in the interest of China in and its development.
We saw this at the end of March, a little group of anti-corruption activists. And as you say, I mean, this is the new leader of China, Xi Jinping, has been pushing this anti-corruption line. But they unfurled banners in a big plaza in the middle of Beijing against corruption, four of them. They were all arrested pretty quickly, charged with illegal assembly. Illegal assembly, that crime in China carries a potential five-year sentence. It's a long time, Tiana, for, in their case, unfurling banners calling for the same thing as the leader of China. Let's stop corruption. Wouldn't you say 5 years if that's what they get?
Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, definitely. I don't think there can be any justification for putting people away for 5 years, or in my father's case, life, for expressing their opinions.
And then, of course, another story that may hit closer to home for you that we read just last week. This is in Hefei, a town I know well there in Anhui Province, where a 10-year-old daughter of a well-known democracy activist, Zhang Lin, has been prevented from going to school. I guess this is a way of punishing the family for her father's political activism. Have you felt that your family has been punished for your father's activism? Has your family felt that way, Tiana?
Well, as a Canadian citizen, I wouldn't like to compare the oppression that I faced to Annie Zhang's. But I do feel that we've been punished. In particular, I feel like I've been punished because of the year that I spent in D.C. I'm no longer allowed to visit my father. I've been permanently blacklisted, which means I haven't seen my father in over 4 years now. And other members of my family have experienced similar consequences.
How is he allowed to communicate with you and your family, Tiana?
My brother is allowed to go visit him, and some of my other aunts and uncle. And then, aside from that, our communication is limited to the exchange of letters.
And what is your dad saying in those letters to you? What are you saying to him?
Well, I think he says a lot of things that normal fathers would say to their children. He shares with us life lessons he's learned and anecdotes that he thinks that we would like, and things that he's read and interests him. And, of course, we talk about my future career options, his dreams for me, and his hopes for himself.
Fred Hyatt, in 9 days, your book, what did you pick up more or less directly from Tiana's story, and where did you decide to go in a different direction, and why, in your kind of inspired by yarn here?
I sort of did it all backwards, Tom. I met her once, and, you know, somehow something about her courage and her name seized my imagination. Then I wrote the book without asking her permission. Then I sent her the manuscript and said, would this be okay? And really only after it became published did Tiana and I begin to really get to know each other. So what I took was this idea of two kids up against something really large and deciding that they have to try and do something about it because nobody else is going to. Exactly what happens to her father and the success they do or don't have, and how the story unfolds, and particularly their friendship, which is a big part of the story. That was all stuff I made up.
What do you hope young readers take from this tale when they look out on this giant scale geopolitics, which you have these two youngsters running up against, Fred?
We have in the book, actually, Tiana wrote a beautiful afterword, and I wrote one too about, you know, well, if you're interested in these issues, here's some of the things you can do. I mean, I do hope that the Chinese government will read this and think, really, there's no point in holding this guy. There's no point in preventing this young woman from seeing her father. But I also, you know, I hope some kids will read it and think, these are interesting issues. These are exciting issues. These are things where somebody can make a difference, and get motivated to read about Wang Bingzhang and a lot of other, you know, there are just so many brave people around the world who stand up, as John Kerry said in that clip, for freedom, you know, and most of them do it knowing nobody will ever hear their name. They're never going to win a Nobel Peace Prize. They may be in solitary confinement for years with the United States and all of us not having no idea what's going on. And they're doing it just because they believe in it. And that's kind of an incredible thing, which I think a lot of young people could be inspired by.
You write in your epilogue that according to Amnesty International, 500,000 people in China are in punitive detention, never charged with a crime. Tian, it's interesting. We have people writing in online saying, you know, how can companies invest in China when this kind of thing is going on? We've got others saying, look, the United States has plenty of its own problems. Here's Jim writes in, and he says, what's important today is not democracy. He says he believes the next movement is the fight against inequality and corruption, that those are more important. I know you've said that your father has not lost faith in the possibility of democracy for China, but what about you, Tiana, and your generation? How important do you think democracy is for China, and what do you think of the chances of it coming in your lifetime or his?
Just first of all, I just want to say that it may be that the fight against inequality may be more important than the fight against democracy, but none of that takes away from how wrong it is to keep my father in prison. And as for the second question, I think that people in China are inevitably going to experience more and more freedom and cultural exchange, and that those who face oppression will realize that they can demand to be treated with respect and dignity and fairness. So I'm confident that change will happen, but if it does, I think that it won't be the result simply of progression of time, but rather because a few people will be brave enough to stick their necks out for it.
You sound like a very worthy daughter. What's your the last time you met with your dad, what were the circumstances, Tiana?
The last time I saw my father was in November 2008. I went to go see him in prison. Our prison visits are very limited. Not very intimate, I should say. They are conducted in a visitation booth, and we can speak on the phone while being separated by metal bars and glass, and we have about 30 minutes to talk, during which there's four guards monitoring our conversation. And I just think that that the whole experience is really degrading and unnecessarily cruel. And I think that sort of experience is actually quite revealing on the level of respect that exists in for human rights that exists in China right now.
Your family continues to be able to see him, but you do not? Is that what you were telling us?
Yes. A few of my family members are allowed to go into China, and they try to do so as often as possible, but it's been over 10 years now, so it's exhausting and expensive and something that's really difficult to keep up with, given that all my family members live in North America.
I guess, Tiana, we're going to talk a bit more with Fred about some other things, but your final thought or your wish to all of our listeners thinking about what they might do for your dad?
I just want to make sure that my father's story is not forgotten, and I just hope that by sharing this story that people can feel connected to issues that seem so far away. And I know it's difficult for anyone to feel genuinely touched by problems that seem removed, but I hope by sharing this that, you know, I've built a bridge, I guess, so that people can feel closer to the realities of human rights issues in China.
Well, I feel enormous respect for the work you've done, Tiana, and for your outlook and your message. I'm grateful to you for being with us today for a few minutes from Taiwan. Tiana Wang, daughter of Wang Bingzhang, imprisoned in China for more than 10 years now. Inspiration for the story, 9 Days, by Fred Hyatt, who's with us in Washington. Fred, stand by. Tiana Wang in Taipei, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Washington Post editorial page editor Fred Hyatt about his new Inspired By, a True Story fiction on an imprisoned dissident in China and his daughters. fight to free him. It's called 9 Days. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And we're looking at the big issues on the table in Washington right now with the guy who for a long time has, they used to call it a big stick that he swung. Maybe things have changed a little bit in the internet age, but it's still big in Washington if you run that editorial page. Fred Hyatt joins us from Washington. Fred, can we take your novelist hat off for a second here and look around your town?
Sure. I just would hope you can see why even one meeting with Tiana was inspiring.
Incredible. Incredible.
Isn't she amazing?
What father would not hope for such a daughter? Just so clear-eyed and well-spoken, and one can only imagine how difficult that path has been. I mean, just, yes, I understand.
And she bears it with amazing grace.
Amazing grace. Amazing grace. And I'm glad that you have brought it back to public attention with 9 Days, Fred. Let's look at Washington right now. It's an interesting moment. Over the weekend, Maureen Dowd really going hammer and tongs after Barack Obama, saying, look, you're in your second term. You won re-election. Americans, 90% wanted universal background checks on the purchase of guns as outlined in the legislation that failed last week in the U.S. Senate. She said, you could have done this, Mr. President, if you just knew how to and were willing to roll up your sleeves and get into the nitty-gritty of presidential power politics in Washington. This is a critique of the president we heard in the first term. Now here we are in the second term, and here's one voice delivering it again. Do you think, Fred, from your perch, that Barack Obama could have brought about a different outcome in last week's vote, or was the NRA just too powerful? Are politicians just too frightened even now after Newtown of this issue? Is the Senate's, you know, the power base in Wyoming and North Dakota and Kansas and you name it just too strong? What about it?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because on Saturday I was feeling kind of good, even though it had been such a terrible week because, well, at least it seemed as though everything had been wrapped up, right? The alleged Boston Marathon people arrested, the rice and letter guy arrested. The poison letters and even the people who were responsible for shooting the DAs down in Texas, those suspects arrested. And you thought, well, you know, that's kind of a good mm-hmm. thing. And what it meant was by Saturday afternoon or Sunday morning, everybody was back attacking each other for who was to blame for this and who was to blame for that, and sort of back to Washington as normal.
Life in Washington.
Yeah. I honestly don't share. I think you can be critical of Obama for not having paid much attention to guns during his first term. He didn't make it an issue in
certainly his did not.
Election or his reelection. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he then turned to it and really devoted himself to it. And it's a hard issue politically. And I think you have to look at it as, well, we've made some progress. You know, a year ago, Democrats wouldn't even talk about this. The NRA was absolute, you know, I'm not going there. And that's changed. And it's changed in part because of leadership that President Obama showed. And I think the question now is, will people try and sustain that and keep moving on it, which I think people will. But, you know, when you have so many senators coming from states where the NRA is not seen as the enemy but is really seen as the good guy, it's very hard to make progress on this issue.
But how can this be a hard issue politically when universal background
90%.
Checks are supported by 90% in a democracy? I mean, what does that mean? Does it mean you have a Senate, you know, owned by the NRA, corrupted? I mean, you put the 90% up against the vote, and a lot of people will feel that's an outrage. Now, the Senate has a particular construction. You're talking about it there. Even so, 90%, but no passage?
Yeah, I get that. And it's discouraging. And, you know, we wrote an editorial calling the Democrats who went the wrong way and cowardly and attacking the Republicans who almost in lockstep wouldn't take a chance. There were four who did and I think deserve a lot of credit. But, you know, it is a familiar thing where the NRA and a lot of other special interests can mobilize people who really care about one issue. And the rest of us, you know, well, yeah, we favor background checks, but we also care about immigration or Syria or the budget or Social Security. And so if you're a senator from North Dakota and you're going to have to take a lot of hard votes on immigration and maybe gay marriage and other things, you have to think it's not so much the 90%, in my opinion, it's that they're having to think, do I want to look at somebody who's against the NRA or who's for the NRA? Am I going to be somebody who understands that most of my constituents don't look at guns as a bad thing and really do value the Second Amendment as they conceive of it? And so they're making almost a cultural choice there.
Of course, there are plenty of NRA members who were for universal registration as well, and certainly being for it, I don't think you can equate it with seeing guns as necessarily a bad thing. It's registration, but you're right in the middle of it. Fred, let me get a call here from Charleston, South Carolina. Mary Jo, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I'm calling just to try and get a picture of how they can rationalize requiring people to register to vote and come up with all kinds of identification. For me to get a driver's license, I have to pass a number of tests and register. And how is that any different than owning a gun and having to register it?
I mean, when you put it that way, it is hard to explain sometimes. Mary Jo, I appreciate your call. Fred, you've got this picture, you know, that people are saying, yeah, you're registering, you know, your automobile. You've got to register for your driver's license. There's a big emphasis on registering for voting. And yes, there's the structure of the Senate, but you know, have you got also another structure? Gun industry owns the NRA. NRA owns the Senate. Logic defied.
It's a great question, and I completely agree. You know, they were trying to defeat the registration thing in the background check thing for personal sales and gun show by saying,
yeah,
oh well, it's such a, you know, burden to, we'd have to go down and sign a piece of paper.
But that was taken out.
And besides, when you sell a car, you know, don't you exchange the title? How difficult is it? And when we're talking about something that can kill people, I totally agree with the caller. And it's very discouraging that even what became the most watered-down bill, I mean, you know, you could ask how much good was it going to do if we're not even going to ban, you know, the magazine clips, let alone the assault weapons. But even this most watered-down bill couldn't get through the easier house. It's discouraging. All I'm saying is that in this very irrational and poisonous place we are on gun politics, it was better this year than it was a year ago. And I think there's reason for people to not be entirely discouraged that certain elements of the political conversation that you know, the politicians in their cowardice or whatever you want to call it wouldn't even allow are now taking place. And the movement of President Obama is a good indication of that.
Well, long haul, but that movement didn't move the vote. Richard in Lowell, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I'm just confused by this. I feel completely misrepresented. When 90% of the population wants something so simple and something you'd think would just be there for the safety of its people, and our representatives don't push it through, how do you not feel that we live in a corrupt and broken system? It's just completely disheartening.
Well, what about the complaint about the president? Maureen Dowd made in the New York Times this weekend. She said, look, if this president would roll up his sleeves and get in there and play hardball and, you know, sing the sweet song to those he has to and come down hard on those he has to, this could have passed. What about that, Richard?
No, I definitely agree. But at the same time, I mean, every individual has to be responsible for their own acts. If I do something wrong and I get scolded by someone above me, you know, maybe I'll reconsider it. But still, the initial decision is mine. And if all my constituents want me to, you know, to push universal background check, which is not an unreasonable thing, I'm not telling people they can't have guns. I'm saying simply, if you're a criminal and you want to buy a weapon, we should know about it.
But what if you're in North Dakota or Wyoming and your constituents don't want that, even though there are many fewer of them than in, you know, you name it, Illinois or Florida or California or any, so many other states you can name?
Well, then I think you have the right and you have the responsibility to vote for your constituents. But if everyone did that, then we wouldn't have to worry about those people in North Dakota or Wyoming because it would have passed.
Well, yeah, there we are. Richard, thanks for calling. David in Boston. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a retired U.S. Army, and I'm an NRA instructor, and I'm a Republican, and I'm for universal background checks. I'm for an assault weapons ban. I am for a large capacity ban. I have no problem with any of those issues, but I would tell you that I think the majority of gun owners feel that it's sort of a slippery slope, and it's not that they're diametrically opposed to some of these actual bills. It's that their concern is that this is one step in a direction that ultimately leads to an all-out ban. And I'll point out one other thing. Here in the state of Massachusetts, I teach the safety course that is a requirement in order to get your license. And I've had, over the past year, a number of students who have taken my course, gone down and tried to get their license and followed all the rules and all the instructions. And it's been 16 weeks and they still haven't received their license. And in the city of Quincy, they're telling people, well, you know what, we're not even going to take your application. You need to come back in September because we have too much of a backlog. So they see the bureaucracy getting involved and the effect that would have on them as legal gun owners that want to follow the rules, just sort of being stymied at every path.
Okay. I mean, I get the perspective, and I get that you're for it, David, but, I mean, overall, it's not as if Americans haven't had plenty of opportunities to buy guns. You know what the numbers of guns are in this country. You're an NRA member, not just a member, but an instructor. Let me ask you, do you think this is a genuine NRA concern about a slippery slope, or is this a gun industry behind the NRA that wants every sale it can get and no friction, no resistance?
I honestly think that the NRA truly views this as a slippery slope. I receive correspondence from the NRA management, senior management, all the time, and that's really how they look at it. And they feel that this is sort of just one step in a direction to take us to where we become Australia, and guns are just simply banned outright.
Assault weapons in Australia.
Guns in general. I mean, if you look at Australia, not just assault weapons, but even some of the more basic hunting rifles have been banned, where you can essentially only purchase, say, shotguns and things of that nature in Australia. So,
David, we got it. I appreciate your call very much. Fred, I want to turn to another front while we can, and David, thanks for that. Let's look at immigration. Big head of steam on this, bipartisan. Last week we were hearing a lot about it until the Boston Marathon bombings suddenly just took over everything. Now some pushback saying, look, these alleged bombers, immigrants, we got to be more careful. But the story was sort of bipartisan inevitability to something coming here. How do you see that now, Fred? Is that still the case?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, our editorial page, it's like we've been pushing for gun control for years. We've been pushing for comprehensive immigration reform for years. And I think it does have a better chance than it's had in a long time. There are people now saying, oh, you see, these immigrants can be dangerous. We better be careful. The people you're hearing that from are mostly the people who are against the bill anyway and are just hoping that they can seize on a new argument. And in my opinion, the argument is kind of ridiculous in this case and really should push the other way. If you're concerned about public safety, don't you want to get the 11 million people out of the shadows and into some legal regimen so you know who's here? And if I were managing the immigration reform bill, that certainly is how I would be trying to spin the latest events.
What about the strength of the so-called Gang of Eight? How strong do you see this bipartisan alliance being behind the outline? We're going to talk about it more tomorrow, but behind the outline of a reform.
I think it's a good group. I think it has a reasonable chance in the Senate. It gets harder in the House. You always have to sort of weigh your cynicism against your hopefulness here. And on the cynical side, you have to worry that there are Democrats who won't be unhappy if they just have this as an issue 2 years from now, if they can blame it on the Republicans. And there are Republicans who don't want to see all these Hispanics become voters because they worry that most of them will vote Democratic. On the hopeful side, there are a lot of people who, out of genuine humanitarian and good government reasons, want it to happen. And, you know, there are Republicans who, after the last election, recognize that it's not in their interest to be seen as the anti-immigrant party. So, I think there's a chance something could happen, but it's still going to be a hard slog.
Hey, Fred, let's take it back to Asia while we've got you. You and I shared time there together as correspondents out of Tokyo looking at Korea and well beyond. A lot of heat out of the Korean Peninsula in the last couple of weeks. Still a lot of hot rhetoric out of there. Are we going to be right back into staring down that issue once the marathon bombing headlines are behind us? Or do you think it's cooling down?
There seemed to be some signs that the North was cooling down the rhetoric a little bit. I think the Obama administration has been very clear that they're not going to reward threats. And as they say, they don't want to go back and play the same game where they give something away again and again and don't ever get anything back. The truth is, though, you know, nobody really has a good sense of what this new guy is up to, what his goals are. And so that makes it a scary situation.
And how about you, Fred, with all your web blogging competitors out there now voicing, you know, 60 trillion opinions a minute? Are you still the tail that wags the dog, Mr. Editorial Page Editor?
Web? What's the web? There are a lot of people pushing opinions, and we try and hold our own by being thoughtful and offering measured opinions that can have some staying power in the conversation.
Fred Hyatt, editorial page editor, former correspondent for The Washington Post. His new book is 9 Days, and you hear the story. Fred, I think, first of all, I think we're all grateful to you for introducing us to Tiana Wong and her father's story and her just amazing profile and perseverance. We thank you for that. We thank you for the book and your time as well. The book is 9 Days. Thanks for being with us this hour, Fred.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.